11 hours Greenwich Mean Time. In the World Service of the BBC, this is Martin Handley with Newsdesk. The headlines: a congressional committee in the United States is expected to authorize the release later today of the videotape of President Clinton's grand jury evidence about Monica Lewinsky. The Taliban leader in Afghanistan has warned Iran that any invasion would lead to a war lasting for decades. Parliament in Albania is to decide whether to lift immunity from prosecution from opposition leaders following this week's riots. And there's renewed tension between Singapore and Malaysia. This time Malaysia is restricting the use of its airspace. Also in the next half hour, mounting tension in Lesotho ahead of a report into alleged irregularities in the recent elections, and unemployment in Hong Kong reaches its highest level for 15 years. The Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives is meeting later today to decide whether to release the videotape of President Clinton giving evidence to a grand jury on his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. Democrats on the committee have criticized the proposal as a politically motivated attempt to embarrass the president. Republicans argue that the tape would allow viewers to judge for themselves. President Clinton has made it clear he's no intention of resigning. From Washington, Paul Reynolds reports.
Republicans burst into applause when their leader said at one meeting that the tape should be made public. The Republican majority on the Judiciary Committee will ensure that this happens. Democrats are not happy. One said this was a witch hunt. But it's emerged that Kenneth Starr received permission from a judge a month ago to hand over the material to Congress. One poll shows that 70% of the public do not want the tapes released. But here, as over the question of impeachment, Congress seems at odds with the people. The chairman of the committee, a silver-haired Republican, Henry Hyde, has issued a statement admitting to youthful indiscretions with a woman in the 1960s when they were both married. He said that he would not be intimidated. But his statement is confirmation that members of Congress sitting in judgment on the president are themselves liable to scrutiny.
Paul Reynolds in Washington. The supreme leader of the ruling Taliban movement in Afghanistan, Mullah Omar, has said that his country will never yield to pressure from Iran. In a BBC interview, Mullah Omar said that if Iranian troops invaded Afghanistan, it would lead to a war lasting for decades. Iran massed thousands of troops on the Afghan border when Taliban militiamen killed several Iranian diplomats after capturing the northern Afghan town of Mazar-i-Sharif from opposition forces. Richard Galpin reports from the Afghan capital, Kabul.
In the past week, the rhetoric from both sides in this crisis has become increasingly bellicose, as Iran's bolstered its military forces on the Afghan border with tens of thousands of extra troops. It publicly announced that its armed forces have been put on full alert for the speedy implementation of whatever decision is taken in Tehran. In response, the Taliban supreme leader, Mullah Omar, has now said he will never yield to the Iranian pressure. Instead, he warned the Iranians against starting a war which could last for 20 or 30 years. He reminded Iran of the experience of the Soviet Union, which invaded Afghanistan in 1979 and which was finally forced to withdraw in humiliation 10 years later. He said that if there was an Iranian invasion, Afghans would not only defend their country, but they'd also push Iranian troops far back into their own territory. Mullah Omar also expressed his anger at the United Nations Security Council, which recently condemned the Taliban for the killing of the Iranian diplomats in Mazar-i-Sharif last month. Although the Taliban have admitted that their troops were responsible and have condemned the culprits, Mullah Omar emphasized that the troops were not acting under orders. And he called on the UN to condemn Iran for interfering in Afghanistan. The Taliban accused Iran of providing massive military and financial support to the Afghan opposition parties, and say the Iranians killed in Mazar-i-Sharif were not diplomats, but intelligence officials or military advisers to the opposition.
Richard Galpin in Kabul. The French news agency reporting from Islamabad says the foreign minister of Pakistan, Sartaj Aziz, is in Tehran to try to ease the tension between Iran and Afghanistan. The agency says the mission follows a meeting between the Pakistani prime minister, Nawaz Sharif, and the Pakistani army chief, General Jahangir Karamat. On Tuesday, General Karamat said recent events across Pakistan's western border could lead to a situation that would be disastrous for Islam. You're listening to Newsdesk in the World Service of the BBC. A team of European Union ministers has arrived in Moscow to discuss with the new government ways of resolving Russia's economic crisis. But as the ruble continues to fall, The new Prime Minister, Yevgeny Primakov, is still putting together his cabinet. President Yeltsin says the process could take another week. Andrew Harding reports from Moscow.
The three European Union ministers have come to Moscow hoping to find out how the Russian government intends to halt the country's economic collapse. They could well be disappointed. The West has made it clear that more money is on offer if the Kremlin keeps a tight rein on spending and pushes ahead with key structural reforms. But Russia's new Prime Minister, Yevgeny Primakov, has yet to release any concrete details about his plans. His new cabinet appears to be a jumble of conservatives and moderate reformers who are already giving mixed signals about the way ahead. The central bank chief wants to print more rubles. Another deputy prime minister says that could lead to hyperinflation, a view Western governments share. It's clear that Mr. Primakov is still having some trouble putting together his new team. Officially, he has only one day left, but President Yeltsin announced on Thursday that it could take another week to name the full cabinet, time which Russia can ill afford as the ruble starts to slip again. Mr. Yeltsin said they were having difficulty agreeing on a new finance minister, a crucial job in a country where millions of state workers are demanding to be paid wage arrears and powerful regional leaders are fighting for more funds. A delegation from the IMF is also in town at the moment. It, like the European Union, is waiting anxiously to discover what course Russia is planning to take.
Our Moscow correspondent Andrew Harding. The Albanian parliament meets today to debate whether to strip the former president Sali Berisha and five other opposition leaders of their parliamentary immunity from prosecution. The government accuses Mr. Berisha of fomenting 2 days of rioting in the capital Tirana earlier this week. Mr. Berisha has called on opposition supporters to continue demonstrations against the government until it resigns. Paul Wood is in Tirana and sent this report.
Mr. Berisha's strategy is to continue to challenge the government's authority on the streets, but to do so peacefully. Critics of the opposition leader say he gambled and lost, inciting his supporters to violent demonstrations which he hoped would topple the government, but pulling back when it became clear the socialist authorities would survive. Mr. Berisha and the other Democratic Party leaders deny that they were behind the armed rioting, which at one point saw Parliament, state television and Prime Minister Fatos Nanu's office building in the hands of demonstrators. But parliamentary deputies have been considering whether to lift his immunity, opening the way to charges which could mean up to 25 years in jail. The Democratic Party has for a long time engaged in a boycott of Parliament, so there's little to stop the ruling coalition within the Assembly from taking this decision. Pressure is coming from the international community, which fears that the arrest and prosecution of Mr. Berisha would mean more unrest. Ordinary Albanians I've spoken to seem tired of their country's chronic instability, prepared to believe that both government and opposition parties are corrupt, and just wish both sides would end the crisis and set about improving conditions in what remains Europe's poorest country.
Paul Hood in the Albanian capital, Tirana. The Austrian economics minister, Hannes Farnleitner, has said that unauthorized mining had taken place in the immediate vicinity of a collapse 2 months ago in which 10 men died. Mr. Farnleitner made the remarks just hours before the Austrian parliament was due to debate the mining disaster. Nigel Glass reports from Vienna.
Minister Farnleitner told Austrian state television that the unauthorized workings were 60 meters below the surface and immediately under the crater which devastated the mining village of Lassing in July. Experts have said that the workings may well have triggered off the collapse of the mine, which extracts soft talc. Hannes Farnleitner said if the presence of the tunnels had been known, the rescue attempts in which the 10 men were killed could have been better coordinated. The organization of the rescue has been publicly criticized by politicians and is the subject of an inquiry. According to plans published in the Austrian Courier newspaper, the unauthorized workings extend in three connected arms immediately below the 150-meter-wide crater, which swallowed houses, roads, and a small river. It was the connection between this crater and the mine that caused the workings to flood within hours of the original collapse. The mine is owned by Nature Mineralwerke, which is a subsidiary of the British Rio Tinto Mining Group.
Nigel Glass in Vienna. Israel has announced plans for a major expansion of a Jewish settlement in the north of the West Bank, where two settlers were shot dead last month in an attack blamed on Palestinian gunmen. 600 new homes are to be built at Yitzhar, a tenfold expansion of the settlement, which correspondents describe as one of the most militant on the West Bank. The plans were announced as the American envoy Dennis Ross was in the region to try to revive peace talks. They've been condemned by the Palestinians and by Israeli peace activists who say that half of the homes in Yitzhar are currently uninhabited. Earlier, police evicted several right-wing activists who'd set up an encampment on the planned site of a controversial new settlement south of Jerusalem. Tension is mounting in the tiny southern African kingdom of Lesotho ahead of the release of an independent report into alleged irregularities in elections earlier this year. For more than a month, opposition parties have been staging protests demanding a rerun of the elections which returned the governing party to power. Greg Barrow sent this report from Johannesburg in neighbouring South Africa.
Lesotho is bracing itself for the release of an independent report into electoral irregularities during polls in May this year. The Langa report was compiled by a delegation from regional states led by South Africa. It was finalized more than a week ago, but the authors of the report have prevaricated over its release, leading to suspicion among opposition leaders in Lesotho that its contents are being watered down. Opposition parties have been staging protests in the capital, Maseru, for the past 6 weeks. They're demanding a rerun of the election and have asked King Letsia III to intervene on their behalf. But the king is constitutionally bound to remain above politics. The protests in Maseru have on occasion become violent, with police shooting at armed opposition supporters, leaving at least 5 people dead. The fragile political situation has exposed wide divisions within society, with the state army clearly undecided about how it should act. Earlier this month, young officers arrested senior military officials after a disagreement arose over whether the army should intervene to disperse opposition protesters. Some senior officers are now reported to be seeking asylum in South Africa, while government ministers are warning of the imminent possibility of a military coup. The crisis has once again raised questions about the political and geographical viability of this tiny mountain kingdom, which is landlocked within South Africa, leaving it completely dependent on its powerful neighbour.
Greg Barrow in Johannesburg. You're tuned to Newsdesk, coming to you from the BBC in London. And a reminder of our top story, the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives is meeting later today to decide whether to release videotape of President Clinton's evidence to the grand jury on his affair with Monica Lewinsky. And still to come in the programme, why Spain's armed separatist organisation ETA has decided to declare an indefinite ceasefire. Our correspondent will be reporting from the Basque country after the rest of the main world news and sport. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Gro Harlem Brundtland, says poverty in the former Eastern Bloc and Central Asia has contributed to the first decline in life expectancy in Europe in 50 years. Speaking to the BBC, Mrs. Brundtland said that the widening gap between rich and poor in some countries in Western Europe was also a contributing factor.
Poverty is really the major threat to health, and one has to understand that fact in order to correct and to really promote good health and sustain health in populations. You can really not get healthy populations without attacking economic, social and cultural factors and really abating poverty.
Mrs. Brundtland also warned that unless more money was made available, mortality rates in Europe would increase. She's to address representatives of the WHO in Copenhagen today on the results of a report which revealed that diseases such as diphtheria and tuberculosis, thought to be in decline, have begun to re-emerge in Europe. The report said Europe was still the healthiest region in the world, apart from Japan. But it did say that heavy drinking had led to a life expectancy among Russian men of 56, well below the pension age. An international treaty banning anti-personnel landmines will come into force next March, following its ratification by the West African country Burkina Faso. The United Nations required at least 40 countries to endorse the treaty before it could become international law. A UN spokesman said the world had taken a step towards becoming a safer and more humane place. 130 countries have indicated their willingness to ratify the treaty, though these don't include the United States, China and Russia. They've argued that landmines are legitimate defensive weapons. Doctors in Hong Kong say that there have been a steady rise worldwide in the flesh-eating disease, necrotizing fasciitis, although the number of cases remains low. A leading microbiologist at the University of Hong Kong, Ho Park Leung, said the disease was usually transmitted through contaminated seawater, and he warned against eating raw oysters, which can carry large quantities of bacteria. The rare disease kills up to half those infected, causing skin to melt away within hours, and can produce toxins which lead to multiple failure of internal organs. Diplomatic relations between Malaysia and Singapore have worsened, with Malaysia placing restrictions on the use of its airspace by Singaporean military aircraft. The Malaysian government said the measures were necessary because of overcrowding in the skies. But our Southeast Asia correspondent, Simon Ingram, reports that behind the move is Malaysia's irritation over the publication of a book by Singapore's elder statesman, Lee Kuan Yew.
The always vexed relationship between Singapore and its much larger neighbour, Malaysia, has taken a sharp turn for the worse in recent weeks. A succession of seemingly minor disputes is raising tensions to dangerous levels for two countries whose historical connections run deep. The latest sign of friction has come with Malaysia's announcement that it will no longer allow Singapore military planes automatic access to its airspace. A statement said the current arrangements allowing the Singapore Air Force to stage low-level training flights and to conduct search and rescue operations over Malaysian territory will be terminated as of Friday. These restrictions will clearly hamper the operations of the Singapore Air Force, which, although potent in terms of equipment, has very limited airspace of its own in which to train its pilots. The explanation given by the Malaysian authorities is being dismissed by many observers. They detect instead a none too subtle riposte to the publication this week of a volume of memoirs written by Singapore's elder statesman Lee Kuan Yew, which contained sharp criticism of leading Malaysian politicians. Mr. Lee's recollections of the painful breakup of Singapore's brief federation with Malaysia in 1965 have prompted an angry response in Kuala Lumpur. Malaysian officials accused him of distorting history and of fomenting disharmony between the two countries.
Our Southeast Asia correspondent, Simon Ingram. King Norodom Sihanouk of Cambodia says all-party talks aimed at resolving the crisis in the country since July's elections will be held next week under his chairmanship. A palace statement said the talks in the northern Cambodian town of Siem Reap would bring together the winner of the polls, the Prime Minister Hun Sen, and Prince Norodom Ranariddh, whom Hun Sen toppled as his co-leader last year. Palace sources said all parties had said they were ready to attend, though Prince Ranariddh was demanding prior guarantees of safety for opposition politicians. Hun Sen's party won the Cambodian elections, but doesn't have enough seats to form a government alone. Japan has called for a free trade zone with South Korea. The Japanese ambassador to Seoul said the two countries should examine the idea in order to improve ties at times of economic hardship. Our Tokyo correspondent Juliet Hindle reports that the suggestion has come as a surprise, but is part of preparations for the South Korean president's visit to Japan in October.
Many believe one of the keys to economic recovery in Asia is to find markets for Asian goods. Japan is now proposing a free trade zone between Japan and South Korea. The Japanese ambassador to Seoul, Kazuo Ogura, said in a speech to Korean business leaders that the two countries would find it worthwhile to study the integration of their two economies or setting up a free trade area. He suggested that companies from both countries should form strategic partnerships or mergers. He said that Japan and South Korea should establish global rules on areas of common concern, such as anti-dumping measures, rice trade, and financial affairs. But the proposal comes as a surprise, as the two countries are not obvious marriage partners. There's still deep-felt animosity towards Japan in Korea, a remnant of Japan's colonization of Korea before the Second World War. Japanese films, music, and cultural shows have until recently been almost completely banned. What's more, South Korea and Japan compete for customers in products like cars, ships, and steel. The relationship may soon enter a new era, however, when the South Korean president, Kim Dae-jung, visits Japan in October. A free trade area may form part of his discussions then. He's already laying the groundwork for a cordial reception in Japan in the shape of a glamorous television advertisement. The president himself appears in the advert and says the slogan, "Welcome, Korea."
Yeah. Unemployment in Hong Kong has risen to 5%, its highest level for 15 years. It's the latest in a series of small but steady increases since the beginning of the year, as Asia's economic downturn has forced many local companies to reduce their workforce or to close down altogether. From Hong Kong, Jill McGivering reports.
Thursday's figure of 5% covers the three-month period from June to August this year. It's the latest piece of bad news on an issue which is already causing acute public concern. Hong Kong is now in recession, and job cuts have come at all levels of society. A sharp reduction in tourism and fall in local consumer spending have meant shops, restaurants and leisure services have been some of the worst hit. Continuing high interest rates have damaged many local businesses and brought a dramatic fall in property prices of more than 40% in the past year. The government is working hard to combat the general mood of discontent. In recent months, it's launched new training schemes for the unemployed and announced a number of public infrastructure projects which will provide some new jobs. But with unemployment expected to continue to rise for many months to come, critics are urging the authorities to do more to ease the social impact. The news on unemployment came as the government again defended its controversial decision to intervene in the local stock markets in an effort to ward off speculators. Financial Secretary Donald Cheung described his government's action as rather exceptional, but said he believed the government had been left with no other option. He was responding to criticism from the chairman of the US Federal Reserve, who said on Wednesday that the government's intervention had damaged its credibility.
Our Hong Kong correspondent, Jill McGivering. And news from the financial markets. London's 100 share index is currently down 136 at 5155. Earlier, Tokyo's Nikkei fell 338 to 13859. On the currency markets, the dollar's worth 1 German mark 68 and 133 Japanese yen. The pound is at $1.68. You're listening to Newsdesk here on the BBC World Service, and the time is coming up to 11:22 GMT. Now sport, and the Australian swimmer Susie O'Neill has become the most successful Commonwealth Games athlete of all time. In about an hour and a half's time, one of the highlights of the track and field competition, the 100 metres, takes place in Kuala Lumpur. We can get all the details live from Malaysia and our reporter Russell Fuller.
Until this week, Mike Wendon's tally of 9 gold medals was a Commonwealth Games record. But he's now been surpassed by another Australian swimmer. Susie O'Neill won her 6th gold of these games and her 10th overall in the 200 metres butterfly.
Susie O'Neill has literally blasted down that 50 metres and has left Petrea Thomas for dead. Gold number 6 is heading for this very popular Australian. It'll be 8 medals in total, 6 golds and 3 and 2 silvers. She's not too far outside the world record either. It's a new games record, 206.60. Undoubtedly, undisputedly, the star of the swimming championships here in Kuala Lumpur, Susie O'Neill, gold number 6.
So a slice of history in the pool, and who knows what may happen on the track as Atto Bolden, Frankie Fredericks and Obadili Thompson dispute the men's 100 metres gold medal. Mike Costello is in the Bukit Jalil National Stadium.
And a crowd here of more than 50,000 agog at the prospect of that final taking place in just over an hour and 25 minutes from now. The question remaining after the two semi-finals, how much has each of the three principals got left in reserve? The draw for that final puts Atto Bolden in lane 3, Obadili Thompson of Barbados in 4, and Frankie Fredericks in lane 5. The women's 100 metres will be decided shortly before that. Chandra Sturup of the Bahamas and Philomena Mensah of Canada both qualified in 11.22 seconds from their semi-finals. The steeplechase has been won, not surprisingly, by a Kenyan, by surprisingly by John Kesgay, beating the world record holder Bernard Barmasai in a dramatic photo finish. And just a few moments ago, down below us, the men's 400 metres first semi-final was won by last weekend's World Cup winner Mark Richardson of England.
And I'll finish with news of another Australian success in cricket. The team are through to the final. They've beaten New Zealand by 9 wickets after bowling the Kiwis out for just 58.
Russell Fuller live in Kuala Lumpur. The Australian company appointed to supply condoms for the Olympic Games in Sydney in 2000 says athletes had to be given a daily quota of 3. The head of the firm, Ron Chatwick, said he was rather surprised at the allowance for the Games, which lasts 17 days. The Spanish government has welcomed as a positive step the indefinite ceasefire announced by the Basque separatist organisation ETA. But the Justice Minister, Margarita Mariscal de Gante, said the announcement had to be analysed carefully before drawing any firm conclusions. The Spanish government has said in the past that in addition to a ceasefire, ETA must lay down its arms before talks can begin. ETA says that despite the ceasefire, it's no intention of giving up its goal of independence for the Basque country. David Chukman sent this report from the Basque town of Bilbao.
After 30 years of shootings, bombings and ceasefires that have never lasted, this latest declaration by ETA is being greeted with caution. Here in the Basque country, the reaction on the streets is one of little more than quiet hope. One elderly woman told me she was happy that talks were at last in prospect. One young man said he was pleased, but wouldn't celebrate till peace actually arrived. There's certainly no public euphoria, instead a realization that at best this ceasefire is only the start of what's bound to be a long and difficult process. Not least because the Spanish government holds ETA in contempt and won't open negotiations until ETA lays down its arms. The Justice Minister said today the ceasefire declaration needed very careful study. The Prime Minister, himself a victim of an ETA assassination attempt, will wonder whether this move is merely a stunt ahead of elections in the Basque region next month. A more optimistic view is that ETA and its political wing have watched with admiration the peace moves made in Northern Ireland by the IRA and Sinn Féin and are trying to copy them. What no one here can predict, though, is whether the same degree of progress will be made here.
David Chukman reporting from Bilbao in Spain. And the Spanish artist Pablo Picasso is acknowledged to be one of the most significant and revolutionary artists of the 20th century. His reputation as a painter, sculptor, draftsman and printmaker is unquestioned, but little is known about his work with ceramics. A new exhibition in London, which opens today, focuses on Picasso's clay work. The exhibition at the Royal Academy of Arts is the largest ever held in this medium. Our arts correspondent Razia Iqbal has been there and sent this report.
In the hallowed salon rooms of the Royal Academy of Arts in central London, there is a rare chance to see art by Pablo Picasso never seen before. The exhibition is beautifully arranged in seven gallery rooms and comprises work Picasso did in the later part of his life in the south of France. There are more than 200 unique pieces of work, two-thirds of which have been in private hands for decades and have never been on public display. It is a mere fragment of Picasso's output in the medium. He produced about 1,000 pieces a year. It will shock some, though, that Picasso never learned how to throw a pot on a potter's wheel. He worked with potters who would throw the shapes he wanted. Picasso would then manipulate the clay while it was still wet. There are a series of plates, jugs and pots which appear to suggest that Picasso used ceramics as a sketchbook, trying different things out. And the result in this exhibition makes connections with his paintings, sculptures and prints. Picasso painted bodies on jugs and turned jugs into bodies. He turned women into vases and vases into women. With just a few strokes of yellow paint, a tall vase becomes a woman in a yellow bikini. Amongst the artistic community, there's been some dissent about the notion of this exhibition at all. Decorated ceramics aren't taken as seriously as a sculpture or a vast painting. But for anyone even vaguely interested in beautiful objects, the exhibition is both exhilarating and provocative and shows Picasso once again as a master of invention.
Our arts correspondent Razia Iqbal. An overzealous museum attendant in western India wielding a vacuum cleaner sucked up parts of a 3,000-year-old Egyptian mummy. The curator at Baroda Museum said he'd only recently discovered that the attendant opened an airtight case and gave the mummy a thorough cleaning. The linen bandage was sagging and pieces had peeled off. Now to end Newsdesk, another look at the main stories. The Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives is meeting later today to decide whether to release videotape of President Clinton's evidence to the grand jury on his affair with Monica Lewinsky. The supreme leader of the ruling Taliban movement in Afghanistan has warned that his country will never yield to pressure from Iran. He said that if Iran invaded, it would lead to decades of war. Diplomatic relations between Malaysia and Singapore have worsened, with Malaysia placing restrictions on the use of its airspace by Singaporean military aircraft. And Parliament in Albania is to decide whether to lift immunity from prosecution from opposition leaders following this week's riots. For the past half hour, you've been listening to Newsdesk.